Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Stephen Kosciuszko was 38 years old, he found himself unemployed, alone, blind since birth. He made a decision that would radically change his life. He got a seeing eye dog, and his latest memoir tells the story of how his dog, Corky, opened up the world to him. It's called Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. He'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m., and he's giving a memorial lecture at Grinnell College tomorrow at 4:15 at the Rosenfield Center, and he is with me now. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm thrilled to be back in Iowa City.
And I want to talk about when you were growing up. As you point out and have pointed out many times in your career, saying that somebody's blind doesn't necessarily convey a lot of information because there are so many different levels of blindness and ways that someone can be blind. But you are blind because you were born prematurely. Tell me a little bit about your vision and what it was when you were a child.
Well, I'll start from a recent position, which is to say that when I came to the University of Iowa in 2007 to join the faculty here in Iowa City, I was completely blind because my childhood legal blindness had been compromised and further affected by what I was told were inoperable cataracts. Mm. And so when I came to Iowa City, I had been living without any vision at all for quite a while. And obviously, having a guide dog and assistive technology and all of that made it possible for me to have a successful career. But it was the amazing eye clinic here at the University of Iowa with some world-class physicians here, including Tom Oding, who is a senior surgeon in the College of Ophthalmology here at Iowa in the Carver College of Medicine, who said, "We can remove these cataracts that other people have said they could not touch." And the fear was that by taking them off, they would destroy my very fragile retinas. And that was the childhood prematurity condition that caused my initial legal blindness. Children born prematurely in the 50s were incubated. And incubators in those days had extra oxygen pumped into them. And they did not know until the early 60s, that oxygen actually destroyed the capacity of premature infants' retinas to grow after birth. So I just want to put out a plug to the state of Iowa and their wonderful eye clinic, because you have a world-class. This is a good town for ophthalmology, let me put it that
way. Absolutely, absolutely.
So that's a little off the subject, but I got to give a plug to my friends at the Iowa Carver Eye Clinic.
So now your vision is more similar to what it was like when you were a child.
It is. They were able to restore me to 20/200 in my left eye, sometimes a little better. And, you know, the right eye isn't so hot, but, you know, it still sees better than it did. And so that's a big deal. So, yes, in answer to your question, lots of blind people have some kind of residual vision, or they have peripheral vision, or they see like through a drinking straw, though the rest is dark. There are 100 different types of possible, rather minimal vision that the blind have. So when you see a person going down the street with a white cane or a guide dog, you think they don't see anything. And the truth is they do. That most of them actually can see something.
When you were growing up, your vision was such that you could fake it. You could pretend that you were a person with vision. And that was something that you did because your parents didn't want to admit that you were blind, right?
Right. And that, by the way, I want to say that's not an uncommon story. A lot of people who lose their vision in midlife or later in life experience this deep reluctance to admit how much they cannot see. Lots of young people with marginal vision will try to do everything that the sighted do and, you know, become rather daredevilish, right? Risk takers, right? You would think that this is an unusual story obtaining only to me, but it really isn't true. It's a pretty universal story. In my case, my mom was an alcoholic. She was troubled. She had a lot of personal problems and considerable guilt, I think, also about, you know, my own problems. And her view of the world was, if you don't mention it, it doesn't exist. And so there's an upside to that. I ran into the world and did everything everybody else did, and I became quite brave. The downside is that there was shame built into the disabling condition, and I didn't get the kind of help and really the kind of encouragement to be myself that one all children need, right? So it really wasn't until later in my adult life that I decided really that I needed to turn some corners and address these things. And I was lucky in that instance that I had a good education. I'd read a lot of good books. I found a good therapist. I joined Al-Anon and understood that my mother's alcoholism wasn't something I had to, you know, bear in quite the way I had been. So I could take important personal steps, right, toward embracing, as we now say, right, my disability. But
well, and embracing who you are, not just your disability, but your whole person.
Right, right.
When you were growing up with this sense of shame that your parents had about your blindness, I mean, you write in the book about really feeling like you were defective, really knowing that there were just things in the world that were not for you because of this.
Right. So one of the things I talk about in the book is what the culture in America regarding disability was like in the 1950s and early 60s, right? So thinking about my parents' generation, people who grew up in the 30s and 40s, the dominant narrative they had about disability came out of the polio epidemic, and it came out of the kinds of short films that would get shown at the local cinema between, you know, motion pictures. And there was a very famous short narrated by Raymond Massey called The Crippler. And Raymond Massey would do this voice, right? And you'd see this looming shadow falling over healthy little children. And Massey would say, "I'm the crippler. I lurk in the playground. I will destroy your child." And then you hear a little child going, "Please, mister, leave me alone." Right? The crippler was this sort of menacing pervert who would inflict polio on you, right? And then there would be, you know, that kind of noir music, dun, 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 little Billy's life is over now, right? You know? And so that was the narrative about disability in popular culture. And disability was seen as a terrible, absolute calamity, right? And if your child was blind, you know, the idea that that child might go to a public school and live an integrated community life, that was unheard of back then, right? What did people think they knew about blindness? They knew the miracle worker.
Helen Keller.
The Helen Keller story with Anne Bancroft and was it Patty Duke?
Yep.
Yeah, you know, that's what they knew. And so the idea was that blindness was a black and white world in an institution behind a hedgerow, a big iron fence. So disability really was conceived of as a terrible, terrible tragedy. And we now call this the medical model of disability in the field of disability studies, right? The idea is that if the doctor can't cure you, you become a defective human being, a broken patient who now has no value, right? And we know that that's a pernicious idea. It still exists, though, you know, we're making radical, you know, strides toward eliminating it. So that's the world they grew up in, and that's what they knew. And they didn't have any internet. They didn't have any focus groups. They didn't have any literature. They had nothing except, "Your child is disabled." Bum, bum, bum.
So let's get to where you start your memoir, which is when you're 38 years old. And as you said, you had a good education. You had been forcing your way into the world, operating as if you had sight as best you could for a long time. But when you were 38, you lost a job and you were at a real crossroads. In fact, you had someone come to your apartment to help talk about career choices or career opportunities with you. Tell me about that meeting.
So I was unemployed. I had an adjunct teaching job that I lost. I was teaching at the little college that I had gone to as an undergraduate. I'd structured my life around knowing my environment so I could keep pretending I could see. And I describe amusingly coming to Iowa City early before attending the writer's workshop and memorizing the town so I could, you know, function here. And then I lost that job and I realized, oh my God, I really don't know how to go anywhere. How am I going to go out for job interviews or travel the world? And, you know, I was trapped in the neighborhood of my own devising, right? And this man, well-meaning guy, actually, came from the New York State Commission for the Blind to visit me. And he was a lovely guy, you know, but he basically was gloomy. And he said, I don't think you'll ever find another job. Because he saw me as an educated blind person. You do know that 80% of the blind remain unemployed even today, even 26 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. It's a lot of popular misconceptions about what the blind can do. And this is regardless of your level of education. And he looked at my resume, poet, creative writer, English teacher. He said, yeah, this, you know. And then he said, there's a local cottage industry, you know, one of these sheltered workshops that provides the disabled with sub-minimum wage jobs. And he said, they probably have a job for you. He said, I think they make plastic lemons for lemon juice, you know. And the writer in me was amused by this. I thought, okay, that's good. That'll go into a book someday, right, you know.
But what a depressing just verdict on your life for him to say, you're not going to get another job.
It was and it wasn't, you know, because I think a lot of your listeners will know that when, you know, the chips are down and someone says something that's wholly out of left field like that, you have enough irony to say, that's not true. That's just not true, right?
Well, you do. And thank goodness you do. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And we're going to talk about what happened next after that point. With me today is Stephen Kosciusko. His latest book is Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. It's about when he was matched with his first seeing eye dog. And he'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 7 p.m. He'll also be giving a lecture, a memorial lecture at Grinnell College tomorrow at 4:15 at the Rosenfield Center, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Stephen Kosciusko. He is the author of Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. It's his latest memoir, and it tells the story of when he was matched with his first seeing eye dog. He's been blind since birth, but he was 38 years old before he connected with a seeing eye dog. And Steve, just before the break, we were talking about this pivotal moment in your life. You're unemployed. You don't have prospects of finding another job, you are alone, and you have to make a decision about doing something different in your life. What made you think of a seeing eye dog? What helped you come to that decision?
The first thing I did was to train with a orientation and mobility instructor from the New York State Commission for the Blind. He came to see me and showed me how to use a white cane, which alerts cars, right, drivers, that you know, here you come. And you may not see them.
Right. And it's pretty remarkable that you were 38 and had never used a white cane.
That's exactly right. And, you know, thanks, Mom, you know. And she was still alive then. She goes, oh, I'm sorry you're doing that. And I said, why is that? She said, well, people will know you can't see. And I said, that's the point, you know. And she also said that when I decided to get the dog, right? I said, yeah, you know, don't worry, Mom. You're missing the story here, right? But I was walking along in Ithaca, New York, a little college town, much like Iowa City, and I had the white cane, and I almost got hit by a Chevrolet because I just didn't hear it. And I thought, you know, I knew enough about guide dogs to know that they're trained to help you avoid those moments. It's called intelligent disobedience. The dog won't let you step into harm's way. And it just sort of, the little light bulb, like a, you know, Bugs Bunny cartoon, the light bulb went off over my head. And I went, I like dogs. Why not get one of those, right? And so I went home and I had a pamphlet from the guide dog school that hanging around, and I just called them, and that was it, right? You know, then they came to see me and interviewed me, and that was the opening of a whole new horizon.
Well, I love the advice you got before you went to the guide dog school to meet your first dog. You said, what else do I need to do to prepare? And they said, hit the gym.
Right.
Because right. You're going to be moving fast and doing a lot of walking. So what was that week like leading up to going to meet your first dog? What was going through your mind?
A number of things, right? One was, and I think everybody can relate to this, I thought, what if I'm not good enough for this, right? You know, I mean, I'm going to go to a guide dog school. It's like a kibbutz. You live there for a month. You train with the dog. You know, what if I flunk out, right? You know, so there's a little self-doubt about that, right? It would be like going to skiing camp, you know, snowboarding camp or something, right? I mean, I hope I'm good enough for this. And then, of course, there was just this sense of I'm really making a commitment to something rather remarkable. You know, what will happen? What will transpire, right? So that was in my mind. And then also, I think I had some naive ideas, right? I thought they'd hand me this super smart dog and they'd give me a handful of things to say to the dog and that would be it. I didn't realize the depth of the training, that guide dog training is a month-long process. You're not only learning what the dog knows, and the dog knows a lot by the time they're giving it to you. It's already trained, right? But that it really is a kind of Zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance unfolding of detail and discipline and a range of things that you need to do in order to work effectively with the dog. And you're testing yourself at every turn. I mean, learning to trust a dog in traffic, that's a sea change in the life of a mind, any mind. So I was unprepared for the real profound change that was coming.
And it's not, I can imagine that it's easy to think about it as if you're acquiring a tool, but it's an entire life transformation.
It's a complete life transformation. And that's where I began to understand as I was writing the book and revisiting this. That's where the subtitle comes in, A Poet's Journey, because this dog was changing me on the inside in all kinds of remarkable ways.
Let's talk about when you first met your dog. How did that happen? How did they introduce Corky to you?
So guide dog schools introduce you to the dog in a kind of wonderful celebration. You go into a big room and you sit in a chair and they bring the dog in via a far door, and then they have you call the dog, and the dog makes a beeline right for you. And Corky, as I say in the book, just burst in like a clown. I mean, she came racing for me. She jumped up, put her paws on my shoulders, began washing my face. And, you know, any dog lover understands this, right? Like, oh my gosh, this is an absolutely stunning creature, and she already loves me, right?
And she was a yellow lab.
She was a big yellow lab, yeah. Really big yellow lab. I mean, I used to joke that she had a head that was bigger than mine, you know.
How old was Corky?
When I got Corky, she was 3. Usually a guide dog is 2 when it's paired with someone, but Corky had gone out with someone prior to me, a blind person, but she was so fast that that person couldn't keep up with her, and so they, you know, returned her. And then I came along and they went, ah, Eureka, this is Corky's guy, because I am very fast. And that was perfect, right, you know.
So you met Corky, and, you know, a lot of us, when we see people with guide dogs, we just see the dog working. So we don't see the relationship between the blind person and their dog. So building that relationship between the two of you, that was the most important first step, right?
Yeah, and it's a complex transformation, right? They call it turning over. The dog is turning over to its person. Formerly, right, it's attached to the trainer, who's been with it for, you know, a year. And so the dog is learning that you're the new person. And so that's partly why you spend 30 days together, right? That process is sequential, dynamic. It requires that the dog begins to trust you. It requires that you begin to trust the dog. You form a bond. And the dog realizes that you do know what you're doing, and the dog can count on you as much as you can count on it.
And love you. I mean, when a dog loses someone that they love, they can go through a mourning period, but you can't have a mourning period when you're making this transition, right?
You can't. And of course, the thing is, you're not sitting around a lot wasting time in guide dog training. You're up at the crack of dawn, you're out, you're working, you're doing things together. Then they encourage you to take the dog to the play area and let it loose and throw toys for it and play tug of war and roughhouse and, you know, do all of those things that dogs and people love to do together that are not work and are just tomfoolery and shenanigans. And Corky loved tug of war. I mean, really, you know, so we're not only working, but we're also, you know, having fun and blowing off steam. And, you know, I think it was really at the end of the first week that one of the trainers said, that dog loves you. You know, we were making the transformation very quickly.
Now, you mentioned that Corky was fast. And that's another thing that I think a lot of us don't understand about how guide dogs work, because we see a person with their dog, they're walking together. It looks very natural. We know that dogs are taught to heel, but guide dogs aren't taught to heel, are they?
No, they're taught to pull. And the harness on a guide dog is made of steel. It's got leather sewn over it, but it's got no slack in it. So when the dog pulls out, you're going with the dog and the dog is setting the pace. I mean, you've got commands. You can say slower or faster, but in general terms, the dog is working at its natural pace. And because there's no slack, the dog has a kind of directional control with your body as you move. So if the dog sees somebody out of control on a skateboard half a block away, the dog can take evasive maneuvers and keep going. And you're not losing your stride. You're not slowing down. You just keep moving. The other thing is that when the dog decides to back up fast because of something unforeseen by the human partner, maybe a car jumping a curb or a bus or something, right? There's no slack in that harness. So you move with the dog. You're going very quickly. There's no waiting. And in general terms, they try very hard to pair each blind person with the dog that matches their stride. So not all guide dogs are, as they say in New Hampshire, where I grew up, wicked fast, right? Some are a little more genial in their pacing, right? It's just that the dogs that I've had are generally speedy.
I'm talking with Stephen Cusisto. His latest memoir is Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. And you mentioned that the dog is taught to think about your physicality, where your body is. When they move through space, they are making sure that there's enough space for them and for you as you're moving along. Corky was fast. What was it like the first time you really turned yourself over to her and walked?
It was fantastic because it was like flying and swimming and skydiving. And once you trust that dog and it's looking for everything and making decisions and you realize you can count on this, then something happens inside you, right? That it's just a transformation, a switch is clicked. And I think actually you have a kind of ancient relationship then with an animal. Ancient people understood that they could count on animals in ways that, you know, the postmodern urbanized people no longer understand. And so it's a kind of magic. And not only are you changed by the experience, once you trust that animal, you become more outgoing and confident and relaxed. Right? The dog really is a creature you can count on. I mean, I remember after she stopped for a curb and a set of steps, she just stopped dead until I could find them. And I said to the trainer who was following behind us, I said, will she always do that? And she said, she will always do that. And that's true.
And for you, being almost 40 years old and having operated without a cane, without vision, from your entire life. I mean, that must have been really one of the first times you felt that kind of freedom to move without fear.
Exactly. And again, that's why I say it's a poet's journey because, you know, Emily Dickinson says famously in one of her poems that when we feel something keenly, it changes us inside, right? The difference is internal, she says, where the meanings are, right? So the inside of me is being transformed by the outside world working with this dog. And that transformation, it's multiple transformations, right? I suddenly realize I can go places with this dog by myself, I could do things that I had not believed I could do. Shortly after getting Corky, I violate all the guide dog school rules. They say you should go home and spend 3 months at home with your dog. I just immediately went to New York City. And we spent 4 glorious days just doing everything I'd always wanted to do in Manhattan, right? Because I'd never felt like I could go there by myself, right? So we went to a Mets game. We went to a jazz club. We just rode around on the subways. We, you know, went to Coney Island, and it was dazzling, right? We walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, right? I mean, it's just stuff that I never thought I could do. And suddenly I'm doing it. And I laughed. I remember thinking this is like the opening of the Mary Tyler Moore sitcom, you know, like I should throw my hat in the air. You know, I'm going to make it after all. You know, it was amazing.
Well, she's your ticket to freedom. I mean, she opens up the world to you in so many ways, but she also changes what people see when they look at you. Because when you walk into a room, now you can't really blend in. You can't really hide in the shadows. You walk into a room, you've got a very large yellow lab with you. You're the first thing everybody's going to look at.
Correct.
So how does that change your life?
Well, it changes it largely for the good because you're not explaining yourself. You just walk in and people go, okay, here's a guy who can't see. So you're not, playing that game of I can really manage this without anybody's help, right? You don't have to explain to the waiter that you can't read the menu or, you know, whatever, right? I mean, most people are excited about it. They've heard about a guide dog, but they've actually never seen one. So they're kind of thrilled. I go to baseball games sometimes just by myself for the sheer hell of it. I mean, the ushers and the stadium people are just so happy and they want to bring you hot dogs. And, you know, I mean, it's fantastic, right? So from that standpoint, it really does make for a positive social dynamic. And then there are moments where you walk in some place and, you experience some kind of oddness, department store greeter has never seen a guide dog and thinks it's just a regular dog. And, you know, you're not supposed to come in with the dog and you have to explain it to them. And, you know, there's this process. But that's infrequent, you know.
It's funny, you say that guide dogs are rare, and they really are. And writing that in your book made me think really hard about how often I have seen guide dogs in action, and it's not very often. So a lot of people are aware of guide dogs and understand what they do, even if they've never seen them. But you're still an ambassador. I mean, you're still teaching people about this because it's not something that most people have experienced.
Yeah. And, you know, I try hard, really hard to be nice. You know, like, for instance, you're not supposed to pet a guide dog when it's wearing its trademark harness. Even when it's not guiding you through the streets, it's sitting there minding its own business. And, you know, you really shouldn't pet them. But people have this irresistible need to do it. And I don't bite their heads off. You know, some guide dog users actually get very angry about this. And I try to remain genial and compassionate. I just say politely, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. It's, believe it or not, the dog is working, but thank you. You know, it's a nice dog. And, you know, so on the other hand, right, if you're denied some kind of service because people don't understand that it's a guide dog, like I was prevented at a posh New York restaurant from entering by the maitre d' who said, no dogs are allowed. And I said, it's a guide dog. It's allowed by law. And he kind of pitched a fit. And I finally said, look, here's what's going to happen next. I'm going to call the New York City police. When they get here, they will tell you that it's the law, but then I will file a civil rights grievance against you, and that will cost your business money. So if I were you, I'd go get the manager now before these things happen, right? So you have to be sometimes insistent, but still not lose your temper, right?
That's a tremendous responsibility. I mean, does that weigh on you?
Not as much as you would think. I mean, it did at first until I realized that it's just another facet of being alive. You know, how is that different from you get bad service when you take your car in to get the oil changed and you have to stand up for yourself, right? I mean, I don't know that it's really wildly different from any other dynamic of adulthood.
Maybe not, but it sounds like you have to do it a lot more often than
not as
most...
not as much as you'd think.
Okay. Yeah. All right, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Stephen Cusisto. His latest memoir is Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. It's the story of when he was matched with his first seeing eye dog. And he'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City this evening at 7 p.m. He's going to give a lecture, a memorial lecture at Grinnell College tomorrow at 4:15 at the Rosenfield Center. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join it. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Stephen Cusisto. His latest memoir is Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. And it's about being matched with his very first seeing eye dog and how Corky opened up the world to him. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. in Iowa City. He'll also be at Grinnell College tomorrow giving a memorial lecture at 4:15 at the Rosenfield Center. You are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Steve, before the break, we were talking about how sometimes when you encounter people, they don't understand what a seeing eye dog is and what a seeing eye dog does and your civil rights as a person who is operating with a seeing eye dog. You also run into people who have sometimes some other misunderstandings about a seeing eye dog. There are, of course, a lot of us love dogs and love pet dogs. There are people who feel like it's cruel to have a seeing eye dog, like they don't get to have the kind of life that a normal, quote unquote, normal dog would have. Tell me a little bit about the life of a seeing eye dog, because clearly we see them working. What's a life like for Corky or for Caitlin, the dog that you're with now?
First off, they have a lot of fun. They stress at the guide dog school that these dogs have to have off-duty playtime regularly, every day, right? And so Caitlin has a lot of razzmatazz, silly time. I was mentioning to you off air, we have a little dog at home. He's a Lhasa Apso that we rescued, who adores her. And, you know, big dog and little dog playing tug of war is hilarious. And they steal each other's toys and run around like mad. And of course, you know, Caitlin gets play dates with other big dogs. And so there's all that, right? Even when I'm traveling with her, you know, back at the hotel, I'll pull out the dog toys and we'll have tug of war and total silliness. So they have plenty of fun and a lot of off-duty time where they get to be just a regular dog. When they don't have a harness on, they're a regular dog. The transformation is immediate and stunning. And off with the harness, silly Labrador, right? So that's important. And they even teach you at the guide dog school how to do a massage on your dog, right? So, you know, what's not to like about that? Right? So that's one thing. The other thing is that dogs like to work. You know, a Labrador is a working dog, and guiding a dog, guiding a person through traffic is something they've been trained to do, but they have to want to do it. A lot of guide dogs in training will drop out because they don't want to do it. And, you know, the stress of it or the, you know, routine of it, what have you, the trainers will pick up on this and it's in their body language and they'll say, okay, this dog doesn't want to do this. No guide dog is made to do something that it doesn't want to do. So Caitlin was trained in New York, as was Corky. When I hit New York City, the tail is up, wagging, the head is up, the body posture. It's all about, ha, 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 I'm here. I'm taking on New York. This is what I was meant to do, right? The moment they don't look like they want to do that, then it's, you know, it's retirement time. So, in fact, they really do like it. But I do mention in the book being followed one day in Manhattan, you know, by a kind of a people for the ethical treatment of animals activist who was, you know, outspoken and kind of creepy and inappropriate and yelling at me about the dog's a prisoner. And, you know, I just you know, what can you do with that, right? I mean, you can't educate everybody.
You mentioned that there comes a time when it's time for a guide dog to retire. How do you know?
Well, one way is that they start to slow down, and that's a pretty good indicator. Another is that they don't look so interested in doing it anymore, right? Yeah. And that's an indicator. If you have the kind of family situation that I have been lucky enough to have, I can retire the dog and keep it as a family pet and get a new guide dog. Some people live alone. They have a job. They can't do that. And so they will arrange to have the dog adopted by a good friend or a family member, or they'll bring it back to the school and the school will find a family that will take it. So there's always someone who will, you know, take that dog and give it a really loving home. As I say, I've been lucky. I've been able, like Corky retired and we kept her as a family pet. And we had a black lab named Roscoe who was her best friend. And they just were, you know, they raced around the backyard and had a good time. So that's always nice.
Absolutely. And so when you, let's say, when Corky retired and you were paired with a new guide dog, was there any jealousy there when that dog got the harness?
And no, Corky loved my wife, Connie, and Connie worked at home. And so she had her dog bed right next to Connie's, you know, computer. And, you know, oh, God, she thought this is great. She didn't look unhappy at all.
So you mentioned Connie, and I want to talk about your wife, because earlier in the show, we talked about how when you were young and disability was considered to be such a shameful thing and you were not given adaptive technology or taught how to best use the vision that you had or to make the most out of your life, you did think about yourself as defective in some ways. And you thought that you would always be alone. And it was Corky who not only opened up the world to you, but led to you falling in love. Tell me what happened.
So I went back to work at the guide dog school briefly in an administrative assignment. And while I was there, right, Corky one day goes up a flight of stairs. Upstairs is where the admissions office was. And who comes down the stairs but this big bouncy black Labrador named Roscoe. Roscoe and Corky just began hitting it off and running around and, you know, frolicking.
Love at first sniff.
Love at first sniff. And then Connie comes down the stairs. She's Roscoe's owner. And we wind up, ultimately getting married. And it was a canine love match. The dogs brought us together. It was like right out of, 101 Dalmatians, you know. It's really what it was. What happened.
So, I mean, obviously, many of us have fallen in love. We know a little bit about what that experience is like. But for you, that must have also been a continuation of this personal transformation that being paired with Corky took you on. I mean, it changed for you fundamentally the way you thought about yourself.
So, but here's the thing, right? Lots of people know this. It doesn't matter whether you're disabled or if you maybe you grew up with alcoholic parents or you have only a conditional sense of self-acceptance for any variety of reasons, right? You have romantic encounters with people, but you don't like yourself enough to really have a healthy relationship with someone. And lots of people know this story, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to graduate school here at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I had, you know, romantic involvements with people, but I didn't like myself enough to give myself over to that in a healthy way. After Corky, I liked myself, and therefore I could like other people, right? That's again why this is a poet's journey, right? It's a complete alchemical transformation, right? You can't love someone else unless you really feel good about yourself, right? We all know that. I mean, I hate to sound like Leo Piscalia, the life of Freddie the Leaf or something, but it's true.
The book was not your idea originally to write this memoir. And when your publisher, when Simon & Schuster asked you to write the book, how did you think it was going to be? What was your vision?
Well, I thought this will be easy. And I also thought I'll interview lots of people about guide dogs, trainers, puppy raisers, people who have guide dogs, and the book will write itself. I'll just string this all together in a kind of investigative nonfiction piece. And then I discovered slowly that a lot of people just didn't have a lot to say. A lot of guide dog users feel grateful that they have a dog and they've had a few interesting experiences, but mostly they didn't want to talk. And the guide dog trainers weren't all that interested in talking. And it dawned on me then, well, that's okay, right? I mean, I get it. But on the other hand, I now have to write a book. And so then I realized I had to write this as a memoir, which is a different approach, right? But that was actually a good thing because it became a love poem to Corky.
And you clearly are a very introspective person. Had you really focused on this transformation before? I mean, I know you kept a journal while you and Corky were working together. But what was it like to really focus on this experience?
It brought forward for me how much Corky's time with me opened me up, made me more curious, made me braver, made me more flexible as a personality, made me more trusting. And by the way, all of those things matter if you want to be a writer, right? So actually, Corky was my best creative writing teacher. I'm sorry, Marvin Bell. Marvin's my pal. But yeah, the dog taught me a lot. An enormous amount about just being ecstatic and alive.
What do you want people to understand about Seeing Eye Dogs? I mean, you're talking right now to an audience that probably is aware that they exist and of the job that they do. But still, again, we don't know a lot about them. What do you want people to know?
Oh, boy, there's so much, right? Brian Hare, who is one of the leading neurological researchers into canine cognition, he teaches at Duke University, talks about how we now know that dogs have mirror neurons. They are the only other creature besides human beings and elephants that have mirror neurons insofar as we know. And so that means that dogs actually in the deep tissues of their brains have the capacity to feel our feelings and try to ameliorate them when things are going badly for us. They are deeply empathetic with us. That goes back 30,000 years. And so it's highly likely that dogs taught us to be more empathetic. And that's not a flaky idea, right? So human beings at the very tribal level owe a lot to dogs. And guide dogs, of course, also care deeply about us and are looking out for our best interests. In the book, I say at one point, Corky had my back, right? And I had her back, right? The two of us are, you know, always a six-legged mutual supporting society, right? The other thing about guide dogs is that they're very expensive. They cost about $45,000 a piece. The reason for this is that the guide dog schools breed their own dogs to make them resistant to diseases, hip dysplasias, cancers, illnesses, eye diseases, allergies. They do a lot of work with geneticists from Cornell University's famous Veterinary Institute. And this means that guide dogs are really among the very finest dogs on earth. The guide dog schools absorb all that cost because the blind remain largely unemployed and can't afford the dog. So charitable giving really matters, just like public radio. You know, the industry relies on the good-heartedness and generosity of donors. I worry about that because it's looking more and more like the greatest generation, which was the generation of big donors, is not being supplanted by younger generations in quite the same way. I worry that young people aren't joining the Lions Clubs and the Rotary Clubs and the good civic-hearted organizations that have historically supported this kind of charitable work. And so I talk about that as I travel. But the guide dog is unambiguously good. You know, when someone with deep pockets gives to a guide dog organization, they know that that money is going to something spectacular.
How many different guide dog schools are there in the United States?
In the U.S., there are a dozen, and they are across the country. There's a good one in Michigan. There are a couple in New York. There's a very famous one in New Jersey. It was the first going by the name of the Seeing Eye, from which we get the term Seeing Eye Dog. A great one in California outside of San Francisco. There are approximately a dozen of them, yeah.
And obviously, not every blind person requests a dog, But is there a large unmet need? Do a lot of people get turned away?
No, people don't get turned away unless, to be honest about it, they are irresponsible, because it's really like adopting a child, right? The guide dog school wants to know that you're a person of good judgment, that you're going to take the responsibility of caring for this animal very seriously. They don't want to find out that you're a severe alcoholic with a hatchet buried in the wall of your apartment and that, you know, you're dysfunctional. So you can be refused for not having your act together. But in general terms, the wait is about 8 months in general. And so that's not so bad, right?
And these dogs are raised by volunteers and then returned to the school, where they either pass or fail and either become seeing eye dogs or become wonderful family pets. I'm curious, with the rise of comfort animals, we heard about the person who wanted to bring a peacock, a comfort peacock, on a plane. We hear about people who get, you know, a doctor to write a note for them saying that they need to have their animal with them all the time. Has that made it harder for people with guide dogs?
No, it hasn't made it harder for people with guide dogs, because the guide dog is the gold standard of dogs trained to help people with disabilities, right? It's the few, the proud, the Marines. It was the first actual dog trained to help people with disabilities. And in general, everyone understands this, and your rights are guaranteed by law, both federal and state law. It does mean, however, that people who have genuine service dogs may be asked to produce veterinary certificates and other documentation, which is, of course, inconvenient. The ADA says that if you have a service dog, you can't be asked to show proof of your disability, because that's a medical issue and it's nobody's business. And that's where people can fake a service dog, because they know they can't be asked to prove that it's an actual dog trained to do something for a disability. And so that's a kind of gray area that unethical people who want to bring their family pets on an aircraft exploit. Emotional support animals are not covered by the ADA.
You are now with your fourth seeing eye dog, your fourth guide dog, Caitlin. In the 30 seconds that we have left, you've told us a lot about Corky and what she was like. How's Caitlin different? What's she like?
Caitlin is quite possibly the sweetest creature I have ever known. Corky was loving and a great companion. Caitlin follows me from room to room and puts her head on my knee while I'm writing. I call her the sugar bear. Yeah.
And she takes you out into the world.
That's
and
right.
You take her.
Absolutely.
Stephen Cusisto, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Cusisto, his latest memoir is Have Dog, Will Travel, A Poet's Journey. He will be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City this evening at 7 p.m. He'll be giving a lecture at Grinnell College tomorrow at 4:15 at the Rosenfield Center. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.